This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. For the first time in nearly a quarter of a century, Boston has changed the way it admits students to its prestigious exam schools. Happened in a unanimous vote last night from the Boston School Committee after a last-minute move by Superintendent Brenda Caselius. And the historic vote was not without controversy. Here with the latest WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, welcome back. Okay, Max, let's start with the basics. What did the committee approve?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Tiziana, for the first time in almost 25 years, applicants' backgrounds, who they are, where they come from, is going to count again in admissions to these schools. And I think it's a really big deal. It's going to play out kind of on two different levels. If you're a parent or a student, not that much will change maybe about the experience of applying. You'll try to get good grades. You'll eventually take an entrance exam starting not this fall, but the next. And then if you're at a qualifying average, you'll be eligible to apply. I think the real change is on the district side, and I'm kind of oversimplifying here. The district will start to compare applicants against others from similar backgrounds, similar neighborhoods, census tracts to be specific. So they're creating these eight tiers based on the tracts' rate of poverty, rate of English-speaking households, single-parent households, et cetera. And then the top students from the most underserved neighborhoods will get first pick.
Okay, and it's these census tracts and sort of the mix of what they consider that are what's different. Is that right?
Yeah, so since you judge throughout the prior system of racial quotas back in 1997, the competition to get into these schools kind of got pared down or streamlined. It was just 50% grades, 50% tests. You go out to the top scorers citywide and they can pick a seat. And then once those seats are filled, everyone else is kind of out of luck. Now the system, I think, has a bit more nuance or subtlety. You've got grades counting for 70%, tests for 30%. You can take the test twice. Homeless students or those at high poverty schools get a little point increment. And then you have that system of tiers that I described.
Okay, so what's the case for change and why are some upset about the change?
Well, you know, these schools always sit a little uneasily in the big urban school district. They're public, but they're also exclusive, right? And like Boston Latin School in particular is thought of as this springboard to Harvard or another prestigious university, and then a career in politics or medicine or law. But it's just not for everyone at this point in time. You know, for instance, Latino students make up 40% of the district overall, but just around 13% at BLS. Low-income students, even starker, they're like two-thirds of the district overall, but less than 20% at BLS. And it doesn't mean that everyone is white or wealthy who goes to these schools, especially to Boston Latin. But we heard from resident Judith Nee last night, who said she's in favor of doing some leveling here, but she made this middle class defense of the status quo before the vote last night. Let's hear that.
Do you really think depriving firefighters and civil servants' kids is the way to do this? What does it get you other than deprive everyone of perhaps the one real authentic step up in the world by weakening the rigor of Latin?
So you hear two interesting things there, Tiziana. First, the idea that there's only, quote, one real step up in the world on offer to students in the Boston public schools, and then her use of the word Latin, meaning Boston Latin School. I think so much of this debate is confused by the fact that while this policy would affect three schools, it does seem to be the Boston Latin School that's the third rail here.
Okay, Max, in a minute, we're going to add another voice. But before we do that, there was a last minute surprise from Superintendent Brenda Caselius last night. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was fascinating to watch. Just to go back a bit, this policy was crafted by a pretty heavy duty task force. I know we're going to hear from the co-chair in a moment that worked for like 6 months on the policy. And so at their last meeting, they agreed on the plan that passed last night. Then they meet again the next day and say, never mind, there are forces in the city, political kind of influence that wants there to be 20% to work under the status quo, straight academic rank citywide. Members, as you might imagine, were quite upset about this. Here's attorney Matt Kreger shortly after the change was added in.
The city asked a heck of a lot to do all of this in full compliance with the open meeting laws. And to the extent that there are local elected officials who are weighing in here by doing it in quiet, shame on them. That disgusts me.
In some ways, that might.
No, go ahead.
in some ways, Tiziana, I just wanted to say it may seem like a moot point since we went back to the original policy before the vote. But I think many in the city are wondering, you know, are there forces that are still working to kind of block change? I asked Acting Mayor Kim Janey's office whether she called to request a change and why. She didn't deny it, but she didn't explain. And at the same time, she seemed to be in favor of reform here. So it suggests that other players might have forced her hand.
All right. And last piece of context here. When does the change actually happen now that the vote's done?
Pretty much right away. So an outreach campaign begins, as the district says, immediately after the vote, you know, parents being told the ins and outs of the new system. So those socioeconomic tiers are set to be published and kind of explained in the fall. And then in the winter, the next application cycle begins.
All right, Max Larkin, WBUR education reporter. Thanks. Stay with us. I'll come back to you in a minute, but right now I'm going to bring in another voice. We're turning to Tanisha Sullivan. She is the president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. She also served as the co-chair of the exam school working group. Tanisha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Good to be with you today.
So, Tanisha, you've put a lot of work into this. I know you just heard Max's summary. How are you reacting to last night's vote?
You know, I definitely want to acknowledge that we have taken some significant steps forward in creating greater equality and access for these schools within the district. And also, I think we have, through this process, really helped to move our city forward with respect to the way in which we engage residents, you know, whether they serve on task forces like this one or take a more active role in public comment. I mean, this process really turned the city out in a way that we haven't seen in quite some time. And so I do celebrate the civic engagement that we saw.
So I want to dig into some of the controversy, Tanisha. This alternate proposal that got floated at the last minute, 20% of seats to be filled by the city's top students, quote unquote, regardless of their home neighborhood. You and your co-chair, Michael Contempasas, have suggested that there was outside pressure to do that. Was there, and can you tell us the source of that pressure?
Absolutely, there was external pressure. I mean, I think Max, you know, summed it up nicely. Look, we... I think it's important to note that this process for many members of the task force began a year ago when we were asked to serve on a working group to design an interim policy during the height of the pandemic. And many of us stayed on and we were joined by a few other members on this task force. So this has been about a year-long journey for us. And the task force work really took 5 months, and it involved rigorous debate, a lot of research, data analysis. And, you know, we were all coming at this issue from divergent opinions in many respects. And so when we got to that Monday meeting and it had been a long process. We got to that Monday meeting and finally got to consensus. It was like the skies had opened. And, you know, both Mr. Contempasas and I were pleased that as a task force, we were able to, you know, to get to that point.
So what happened?
So, you know, so the change was certain, or the change was certainly something that, you know, I don't think any member of the task force really wanted. And, you know, I'm just pleased that, you know, as we, you know, certainly presented the 2080 to the school committee for its consideration, that we had task force members who also in the same evening presented a dissenting opinion that put the 100% consensus position of the task force on the table as well.
Was it city councilors? Was it private individuals? Was it state legislators? Can you tell us where that pressure was coming from?
So I do think it's important for us to have a conversation as a city about specifically who, what, and why. But I do want to do that in a constructive way. I definitely, Matt Krueger called it out in his comments. You know, there were elected local, city of Boston, elected officials who were threatening to take action against the Boston Public Schools in a way that would have significantly disadvantaged and impacted some of our most vulnerable students.
Can you give us any more details on those actions?
I know you're going to keep asking, but
no. Okay.
You know. Okay.
So let's have a more constructive conversation. Then I'm hearing from you. I'm not going to answer those questions. We don't have a ton of time, and I think there are a couple of things I can ask you that you will. So the first is: are you worried now that the school committee didn't do the 20% of seats filled by the city's quote unquote top students, that those repercussions are now going to happen? Is there a
Absolutely
risk here
not.
That whatever those, okay.
Absolutely
and why
not.
Are you not worried now?
Because I think the circumstances surrounding, look, I mean, if GBH has reported on this, I think if people, you know, are, observant of the process, then you know that folks know that there were a number of things happening at the time, right? We had not only a city budget that was being voted on by the city council, but also a BPS budget that was being voted on right. by the council on that Wednesday afternoon. City Councilor Lydia Edwards remarked during the city council, during that city council meeting, her concerns about the BPS budget in vis-a-vis the exam school conversation, right? So there were a number of things happening during that period of time that were putting significant political, not just political pressure, generally speaking, because politics is part of policymaking, that it is what it is. But I do think it's important for us to, you know, certainly as we're making decisions in those moments, to be mindful of who can be adversely impacted. And when it comes to adversely impacting our children and specifically our most vulnerable children, then, you know, sometimes we have to be willing to bend and to perhaps take a more circuitous route to achieving our objectives than we would like to. My point okay. is that, right, in the end, I do want to say this, in the end, we, you know, were able to achieve an outcome that was in alignment with what the task force work had yielded.
So it came full circle for you.
Yes.
All right. Tanisha Sullivan, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you.
All right, so still with us is WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, reactions to that?
That was awfully interesting. Tanisha really did work on this for a year. I was watching along, and it was a Herculean effort. She deserves a lot of credit, I think, for that. I think, you know, she did give voice to something that a lot of us had surmised, that the budget was coming up for a vote. And certainly you've got a lot of constituents who are showing up at school committee meetings. I would expect they were also calling their city councilors and saying, you've got to find a way to stop this exam change from going in. So definitely puts a little more meat on the bone of what had been kind of a political mystery of the last few weeks.
So she did say to me, Max, that there is a conversation to be had in detail about what happened. Do you expect to hear more from the task force on that in the days ahead? Do you think there's going to be some public conversation?
I would imagine that conversation, has to continue into the mayoral campaign. First of all, you know, you've got several city councilors running for mayor, running against one another. I think there's going to be questions about whether there could have been a more public, less sort of cloak and dagger way of reckoning with influence and intransigence and sort of durable privilege in the city. And then, there's still a court case that is very, very likely to be pressed and reignited around this policy. And I wonder if we won't be talking about this for months to come.
All right, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. If we are, let's do it together. Thanks for joining us.
I'll be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, another education story. There is a debate roiling K through 12 schools right now in the Commonwealth, and it's one that's only somewhat related to actual education. School leaders are trying to decide whether students will be required to wear masks to start the new school year in the fall. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say vaccinated students don't have to wear masks when they return, but some educators in Massachusetts say that's hard to enforce with a mix of vaccinated and unvaccinated students on campus. WBUR's Angus Chen brings us this report on the debate, which is even dividing the area's top epidemiologists.
The recommendation from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention seems pretty clear. Students who are fully vaccinated don't need to wear masks in the classroom this fall. There's just one problem. Many students are still too young to get vaccinated or simply haven't gotten the shots. The COVID-19 advisory panel for Brookline Public Schools recently discussed this issue. They tried to imagine what the district's new mask policy might be.
You could either make it an educator option for a classroom.
That's Dave Gaishik. He's the co-chair of the panel. He asked Brookline science teacher Liz Crane if she'd want teachers to make their own rules about masking.
To give the classroom teacher the option of saying masks either are or aren't required in my classroom?
That sounds nerve-wracking to me.
Okay.
Crane worries it'll be challenging to enforce different rules for different classrooms.
It just puts a lot of pressure on teachers.
The simpler option is to go with a single rule, require masks for everyone or for no one. Schools are trying to decide which way to go, and epidemiologists haven't made up their minds yet either.
We have enough immunity to keep cases low.
Dr. Shira Daron is a hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center.
So it's got to be based on what is the level of danger in the community to justify mandating masks.
Daron says schools in places with high vaccination rates don't need to require masks. And some communities may have such low rates of COVID, it's unlikely the virus will ever enter the schools.
When the risk is tiny and you continue to mandate mitigation measures, you're not appropriately characterizing the state of the pandemic.
And she says masks can interfere with critical learning needs like social development, language, and even speech therapy. Dr. Andrea Serinello is an infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital. She can see waving masks in some scenarios, but not all.
We're very rightfully a little bit worried about going back to school in the fall.
She thinks it's better to start the academic year with a mask requirement in schools with kids under 12 who aren't yet authorized to get the vaccines.
And I think to start out that way, it's quite a bit easier than to flip the switch in the opposite direction and say, things are actually going really well. Maybe we don't need masking anymore.
So school districts could drop mask requirements mid-year if COVID rates reach a low enough level and vaccinations are high. But the question is, what exactly would that magic number of vaccinated people be?
Yeah, I don't think anyone knows.
That's Dr. Ben Linus, an epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center. He says in theory he agrees, once enough people are vaccinated, that should protect even elementary school kids from the coronavirus. But he doesn't know what enough is.
I think that's what we're struggling with. Like, no one really knows when it would be safe, right? When you can just fall back on herd immunity and know that it's safe.
And it just got even harder to know with more infectious COVID variants like the Delta variant circulating. Plus, Linus says nobody can predict if new vaccine-resistant mutations will emerge.
But it makes me a little nervous to go all in 100% that our only mitigation measure going through this emergence of Delta and getting to the end of the pandemic, we're just going to fall 100% on the safety net of vaccine.
For that reason, Linus thinks masks should still be mandatory, at least in elementary school classrooms. There might be another reason to keep masks on. Almi Abeta, the superintendent of Chelsea Schools, says if mask requirements can help families feel safer sending kids to school in the fall, it might be worth it.
We're just so grateful that we're physically in person because we were in remote for so long that for us, wearing a mask is like not a big deal.
What's more important, she says, is an environment where teachers can meet students face to face. Abeta says Chelsea hasn't made a final decision about mask rules yet. It's something she and other Massachusetts school districts will puzzle over for a few more weeks.
That report from WBUR's Angus Chen. Excuse me. Now let's stay on kids, because if you've got small children especially, you might want to check your bank account, because today is the first day that monthly child tax credit payments will arrive from the Internal Revenue Service.
I believe this is actually a historic day. Historic day in the sense that we continue to build an economy that respects and recognizes the dignity of working class families and middle class families.
President Biden there a little earlier today announcing the beginning of the payments. Now, the IRS estimates it'll get payments out to some 88% of children in the U.S., but the Boston Globe estimates the IRS could miss up to 60,000 children here in the Commonwealth. And Mayor Janey's office says some 5,000 of those children are in Boston. So let's talk about this, about the impact of what the checks will be, the impact of those potentially left out. Let's turn to Dr. Megan Sandel, a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center, also co-director of the GROW Clinic there and principal investigator at Children's Health Watch, and Vicky Negus, policy advocate at the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Dr. Sandel, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tiziana, for having me.
And Vicky Negus, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I want to start nice and basic. Dr. Sandel, this is money that comes back to a family for the costs associated with having kids. It's a credit that's been around for a long time, but now it's bigger, and half of it is being prepaid due to the pandemic. Is that right?
Exactly. I think this is the first time where you're seeing monthly installments given to people in order to have a consistent amount of payment. And I think the other piece is that it's grown. And so the magnitude of this is enormous. We're talking about 1 million children in Massachusetts, 650,000 families getting $250 to $300 per month to help defray the cost of raising children.
Okay, now, Vicky, Dr. Sandel just said $250 to $300. There is a range. So give us a quick rundown of the numbers, please. Who gets what based on income, roughly?
Yeah, a great question. So for families who have children under the age of six, each of those children will receive $300 per child, and for families who per month per child, and for families who have children between the ages of 6 and 17, that amount goes down a bit to $250 per eligible child. And those will be monthly payments until the IRS moves to a lump sum payment in 2022.
And, you know, are those big numbers? I mean, Vicky, bring it home for us. $250, $300 a month. What does that mean for a family?
Yeah, so it can sound like a small amount, but for our lowest income families and for families who are really struggling to make ends meet on a monthly basis, it's really critical. I know Dr. Sandel mentioned this, but it is a game changer when we look at poverty in the United States. The child tax credit experts estimate that if all families who are eligible connect with these dollars, that child poverty rates will be cut in half in 2021. So this is a really big deal. I talked with a mom, a client of mine yesterday, and she did not know these payments were coming in her direction. And she told me, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot, but this is really gonna help me make sure that my teenagers can get through the month with more of what they need. So it's a really big deal for a lot of families.
So Dr. Sandel, one of the concepts that's starting to come mainstream is this idea of the social determinants of health. And really this tax credit plays into being healthy through these other social determinants. Can you explain that for us a little bit and kind of connect the dots between, all right, this money comes in and what do people spend it on that affects health, other than obviously healthcare?
Yeah, it's really interesting, some of the research that's been done in this space, both with the child tax credit and also the earned income tax credit that people often get when they file their taxes. And what we now know is that even small increments of dollars, like an extra $1,000 in your tax return, we have seen research that shows that you have a 8 to 10% reduction in premature births and low birth weight babies. And so as I sometimes will say, if that was a medication, it would be on every pharmacy in the country. It's just really where money is medicine in terms of being able to help you be able to purchase healthier food options, to be able to get you into maybe a safer housing or prevent an eviction, or being able to get you into higher quality health childcare. Those are all really crucial parts of how we are seeing this play out.
So Vicky, the IRS is sort of the center of distribution for these payments. And we have been hearing for days that while that makes sense in some ways, the most low income among us probably don't pay taxes or may not, and therefore may be out of the loop on these payments. One, is that right? Two, how big of a deal is that locally? And three, what are we doing about it?
Yeah, an excellent question. And I think one of the most critical things for families to know at this point. So the IRS has estimated that about nearing 60,000 Massachusetts kids, as the Globe reported, are at risk of being missed in Massachusetts, being missed from these payments, unless their families are able to connect with the IRS through essentially tax paperwork. And the reasons that families don't typically file tax returns are varied. Low or no income families are often not required to file a tax return. And then certain families who may be immigrant families or have mixed status in their families are afraid of coming to the IRS and connecting with the government to receive these dollars. So because of the sheer need to connect low-income families with the child tax credit, we've worked together with Children's Health Watch and with other organizations to stand up findyourfunds.org, which is a statewide website in plain language, in multiple languages, that aims to connect these 60,000 kids with the dollars that their families so critically need. So that is one of the things that we're doing to try to make sure that everybody who's eligible is connected.
So that's findyourfunds.org, and we'll also link to that on our website, radioboston.org. Dr. Sandel, we need to address the criticism. So let me give you three pieces that get leveled here. One, this is a huge government expansion. Two, it's not affordable. And C, that it focuses more on this give a person a fish philosophy than teach a person to fish. I want to take those kind of one at a time. This is a big expansion. Assistant Speaker Catherine Clark told us she'd like to see things like this permanent. Have you done any economic impact analysis about what we get instead? Is this affordable? Are there hidden affordabilities rather than hidden costs to doing this?
Yeah, I think that when we only talk about costs when we don't talk about enough about benefits. So first and foremost, this is a form of economic stimulus. The research suggests over and over again that when you give particularly low-income families these types of tax credits, they spend them. So just to give you a sense, that's $250 million that's going to come to Massachusetts in the next year and be spent in our economy. So it is not just like it goes into a black hole. It actually is a stimulative effect to our economy itself. I think the second that becomes really important is just the scale of what we're talking about. We're talking about 86% of kids having a benefit that has been documented that's going to improve their health. So, for instance, I think what our research at Children's Health Watch has shown is that when kids are food insecure, are housing unstable, families are having to choose between paying for medication or paying for utilities, that has a health benefit or health detriment that can be lifelong. It can result in not doing as well in school and other things. I think one of the things that I hear from my families, honestly, is that now they can afford childcare and get back into the workforce. And so I think this kind of worry that this is somehow not helping people and not and making them potentially stay home is actually the exact opposite of what my experience is.
And are there other policies, Vicky, that need to be in place? Let me backtrack. So the last one was the give a fish versus teach to fish. What about the argument that helping people earn more is a better approach to getting these results than giving families money?
You know, and I think just to piggyback on earlier comments, I think that the question around what is the best way for us to make sure that all of our families can live not in poverty and with opportunities for all children in the United States. And I think the question to really ask is how do we make sure that this child tax credit expansion is made permanent? Because we know that, and the pandemic shed light on this, but we know that there has been an economic crisis in this country for families for a very long time. And we know that those inequities and those challenges that low-income families face across the country, especially communities and families of color, we know that that has existed and been exacerbated by the pandemic. So I think that the question is, there's definitely not one answer. There's a variety of solutions that we need to have in place, you know, a living wage, broader opportunities for broader groups of people. But I think that ensuring this tax credit is made permanent is really one of the biggest and best things we can do to cut down on rates of poverty across the country and certainly in Massachusetts.
So Dr. Sandel, as we're having this conversation, you know, I've been reading that if you don't currently file for taxes, we just talked about that, then you can file for this. Maybe you don't want to get the prepayment of your tax credit, then you can contact the IRS and do that. Taxes are hard. IRS is hard. Most families are busy, stretched, working multiple jobs. This is hard. How can we make it easier?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that I know it may sound strange, but now every family that I see as a doctor, I'm asking them, did you file your taxes in the last 3 years? Hmm. If not, did you go to the non-filer portal, a way in which you can register? Did you get your stimulus payments? And those may sound like weird questions, right, to ask as a doctor. And yet it's just emphasizing how important we think this money is. I think that the good news is there are great resources. Again, findyourfunds.org or childtaxcredit.gov are all important resources. But I think the point that Vicky made is really essential. We know there are 58,000 kids in Massachusetts where their families didn't file in the last 3 years. And so we know just having a website's not going to be sufficient. And so I think there are some really great programs. I want to give a shout out to Dr. Lucy Marcel, who started a program at Boston Medical Center called StreetCred, where we are still doing tax filing. So even though the regular tax filing deadline is passed, you can still file your taxes and make sure that you're getting this payment. And so I do think we're going to have to see, and I think the American Rescue Plan had this, some assistance for people because it is hard. And we want to make sure that things like pediatric offices, we're trusted members of a lot of times our families, that we can say, this is where you need to get this assistance, because we want to make sure everybody who's eligible gets it.
All right. That is Dr. Megan Sandel, a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center, co-director of the GROW Clinic there and principal investigator at Children's Health Watch. Also, Vicky Negus, policy advocate at the Massachusetts Law Reform Institute. Really appreciate it. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. One of the best parts of my job is when I get to bring you something new, something interesting and maybe something unlike anything you've heard before. Our last segment today is that. The song you're hearing right now is called The Seventh Day. It's the second track on a new album from Mehmet Ali Sanlıkal. The album is called An Elegant Ritual, and it comes out tomorrow. Sanlıkal is a Grammy-nominated musician, composer, faculty member at New England Conservatory, and he prides himself on bringing a unique perspective at the intersection of his life experience and his musical training to everything he does musically. This new album is no exception. At its core, it's a jazz trio, but with traditional Turkish elements blended throughout. It's unlike any jazz album, really, you've ever heard. We caught up with Mehmet earlier this week, and I started by asking him how it felt to put together a trio album compared to the larger ensemble projects he's typically known for.
I've been playing with my trio and several other small group setups at least for 2 decades, if not more. It's just that people know me more as a composer, and in fact, a composer active in not just jazz, but in concert music. And other people know me as just a traditional Turkish music performer. But basically, due to a lot of large ensemble or orchestral music or even choral music commitments as a composer, this kind of small band music that I've been working on has kind of been left out, you know, for a long time. And I guess the pandemic gave me an opportunity, you know, with proper social distancing and being smart about all kinds of rules and regulations, we were actually record this trio album, and the result was wonderful. It's just such a pleasure to be able to get back to this music and finally release it.
And this is acoustic bass, piano, and drums, is that right?
Well, the core is the very typical jazz piano trio, meaning it is acoustic bass, piano, and drums. However, because of my compositional wishes and endeavors, you know, I ended up, of course, looking to incorporate innovative ideas And so the innovative ideas that I brought in also ended up bringing in some musical instruments on top. Now, I did want to maintain the very spirit of you know, jazz trio that is has to be live. The interaction has to be on the spot. And so, you know, in order to maintain that, even though I brought in, for example, my ney, the Turkish reed flute, and we have incorporated a lot of nipple gongs like the ones found in Indonesia, everything was played live in this album. So sometimes people will hear me play the piano and the ney at the same time. Well, believe it or not, that's not overdubbed. I actually played them together somehow.
So, okay, you're a professional musician. I have no way of knowing if that's like, meh, not a big deal, or holy cow, you played the ney and the keyboard at the same time live. This wasn't mixed. I mean, is that a truly remarkable thing to do?
Well, okay, you know, asking me that question, you know, I shouldn't be answering, I suppose. Yeah. But okay, you know, allow me, you know, to just this one time to say that, yes, it is difficult. And it took me, you know, many years to get to that point. And what's more important is, of course, I could have gone and hired, you know, some other player. But let me explain as to why I did not do that. You see, it's not often that you can find musicians who are equally comfortable in multiple musical traditions. Meaning, you know, it's not going to be easy to find a Turkish ney player who has both the traditional Turkish music language internalized as well as, you know, jazz internalized. That's very rare. Now, I happen to be in that position because of my history, you know, and that is, you know, my life's history. I came to this country in 1993 to Boston to study jazz, and I had no prior training in Turkish music. I grew up as a classical pianist who discovered jazz, you know, in his teens. And then I came here, and then 7 years after my arrival in the United States is when I rediscovered my roots and dedicated at least about a decade of very strict and disciplined Turkish music and Turkish and related music studies. And so, you know, after all of that is you know, when I finally returned back to my compositions and or composition career, and then this more you know, reconstructed identity started emerging. So it's kind of a necessity. It's not because I'm trying to show off in any way. It's a necessity. It's because I can play them, you know, in a way that I can speak these languages together on these instruments.
And that is the project on this album, is it not?
Whether it's a large ensemble or album or a trio album, you know, that is my project. That is who I am. That's my voice. That's my contribution. And so, you know, I very much endorse the idea of bimusicality, meaning being bilingual in music, you know, or let's say multimusicality, being multimusical, just like being able to speak multiple languages, you know, with equal fluency. That's not easy, right? Same thing with music.
Let's play with that a little bit. I don't know if journey is the right word or if continuum is the right word, but it feels like across this album, you introduce us into this flow of relationship from jazz into more traditional Turkish music. You have one traditional jazz sort of standard called Invitation. That piece feels more in the pocket for what I expect from, you know, a jazz and a jazz trio. It's a standard, but there are hundreds of standards. So I wonder why that one? What did it allow you to do? Or I mean, you could have picked anything. Why did you pick Invitation?
It's a piece that is harmonically more adventurous, but I was looking for a jazz standard to include in this album in its, you know, to honor the tradition of the jazz piano trio more properly. We are playing it in a very kind of open manner. That being said, the underlying rhythmic structure is a kind of beat that is found in Greece and Turkey, kind of in nine beats. But again, it's that one is hidden, you know, unlike, you know, the title track, An Elegant Ritual, where, you know, the Turkish influence is unmistakable. This one is kind of subtle and more, I guess, for specifically for musicians to pick out.
So now you've played a traditional jazz standard. Traditional, let's throw that word out. You've played a jazz standard. You've played with that jazz standard. Now we move ahead, and you've got a song like Hazret. So Hazret, really in one song, takes us on a journey from a more traditional Turkish style into jazz, and this time vocals. So starting with more traditional Turkish style vocals, and then we get towards scatting towards the end. So first, just so, I don't know, satisfying that song and that journey and the connection that you make. And I wondered as I was listening, was the metamorphosis something that you worked to create, or did it seem very obvious to you and you were just showing us? Do you understand my question?
Yes, I do. So it started happening gradually over the past, I'm going to say, maybe 10 years. I started slowly hearing, you know, how I can start transitioning in and out of these different musical languages. I kind of started discovering it. And I think it's different. The way I'm doing it is different than just having, again, two musicians next to each other, you know, who can speak two different languages. But it's music, and one way or the other, you can make it work. You know, if both musicians know how to improvise, they'll find a way to improvise together. That doesn't mean that the musical languages they speak are going to start meshing together. And, you know, a regular audience member may not necessarily be equipped to follow that. In my case, I slowly started discovering that I'm actually able to kind of mash in and out, just kind of like a translator, you know? I'm able to translate between, I recognize patterns, I recognize the best way to translate a certain jazz phrase into the Turkish idiom or vice versa. You know how it is with book translations. They're the most difficult things to do. But you get to do it until after you internalize these languages, you know, and you internalize the vernacular, etc. Same thing with music. It takes many years. But as I started feeling that I'm able to do this in a natural and an internalized fashion, then I started experimenting with it on stage and finally got to this point where, you know, I've been recording on my, you know, past maybe three albums, examples of this. Hasret certainly happens to exemplify myself, you know, showing how I can transition from the traditional Turkish music language to a far more experimental jazz, you know, scat language in a kind of smooth manner using my voice, which has always been a natural extension of my musicianship.
You spent a decade really diving into your Turkish roots, and I wonder, Are you influenced by what's happening in Turkey today? Are you watching? I think it's fair to say that there's been some political upheaval. Are you paying attention to that, engaging with it? And is what's happening there affecting or influencing your music today, or maybe this album?
Turkey has always, you know, been subject to tension just because of its geography. It goes all the way back to Homer. I mean, you know, he talks about Troy, he still talks about East and West. Now, we reinterpret East and West over and over again. But Turkey has always been geographically right there in the center of that tension. And the tension is similar to the kind of tensions we have in the United States, actually. Tension, it is difficult to address and difficult to face and difficult to come to terms with. It also gives people reason to create, innovate. And we see this, as we see very much in the history of the United States and, of course, with jazz. My journey is my journey. I came to, again, rediscover my own roots, and I came to redefine myself as a multi-musical musician. I think this is now becoming more and more necessary for the 21st century because of the challenges of globalism. It just becomes more and more important for us to become aware. Bimusicality or multi-musicality is very important for that awareness.
Do you know what you want your musical legacy to be?
On this album, at the very opening of An Elegant Ritual, you know, the title track, there's a sound that has never been heard before in music history. You hear the very low end of the Ney flute in unison with the very high end of the harmonics on the acoustic bass. I somehow came up with that, and it works. What I'm trying to say is, I'm not necessarily the smartest person that I know. It's not the smarts, but I have this God-given talent, this gift of finding these innovative sounds. And I just want the jazz world, the greater music world, to know of these contributions before I die. It's that simple. It's that simple.
Well, I hope that we'll get lots more of those contributions from you in the future. That's Mehmet Ali Sanlıkol, a Grammy-nominated musician, composer, faculty member at New England Conservatory. His new album is called An Elegant Ritual, and it's out tomorrow. Mehmet, thank you for joining us, for talking about your music and sharing your music with us today.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.